welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. My guest today is an actor, a writer, a director. She's won the Academy Award. She's won an Obie Award. She's won a Drama Desk Award. She's won a second Obie Award for Lifetime Achievement. She's been performing for 9 decades and has been inducted into the American Theater Hall of Fame. Her name, Estelle Parsons. And Estelle, I can't tell you how happy I am to have you on Movie Talk. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, and I love you. You know that.
I do, and I'm...
You and I go back to something called Needle Park, right?
That's right. That's right. But, you know, it's amazing to me that in studying your career, you really have done an awful lot. And with such quality, you should be so proud of almost every credit. And we both know, as acting people have with credit, sometimes they wish they were not near that theater.
Oh, you are funny when you mention credits. I've always been very careful about who I talked to or worked with or anything like that. I remember once, oh gosh, it's so long ago, you know, and I remember walking into this room. My agent, you know, sent me to do something for somebody, and I remember walking into this room and having such a 150% negativism to the air and the energy and the people in that room that I walked out and called my agent and said, I can't do it, whatever it is, I can't do it.
Well,
yeah, isn't that funny? But that's life, right?
It is. Let's go back to Marblehead, Mass, where you were brought up, and let's talk about your dad and mom and their influence on you. Certainly, your father was an extraordinary man, a Harvard graduate, man who went to the Massachusetts representative. I mean, he was really quite something. I guess he got you interested in politics and law.
I don't know. Well, I guess he did. I don't know if he did. I know from the time I was about 6, I was trudging around putting postcards in people's mailboxes when he was, I don't know what, a selectman, and then in the state house. A state representative. I forgot what you call him now.
Yeah, anyway. Representative in the assembly, in the Massachusetts assembly.
Yeah, where they have this sign up. The Lowells speak only to Cabots and the Cabots speak only to God.
That's Massachusetts for you.
That's Boston for you.
Oh, Boston.
Yeah.
Tell me about your mom. She seemed to be the one to get you into community theater. Is that right?
My mother was Swedish. She was born in Sweden. And she was the oldest of, I think, 6 children. She came over here with her mother and father. He was a steel worker, whatever that means, I don't know. But he was courted by the General Electric and then by Carnegie Steel for whatever he did, which was something very special, obviously. But they came to Lynn, Massachusetts, and then Carnegie wanted him to move to Pennsylvania, and my grandmother said, I have come this far, I'm not going any further. So they stayed in Lynn, Massachusetts, and he stayed, I suppose, with the General Electric. I don't know what all happened to him or anybody. Eventually, he died from And a botched appendicitis, of all things. Isn't that bizarre?
Well,
nobody, being a New Englander, we don't talk much about anything. So I'm telling you, Kate, the only history I know. But
that was the history
of that thing. And then my mother took care of all the kids. And she went to, oh, she was a very smart woman. But she didn't get to go to college or anything like that. So she went to secretarial school. And then she worked for my father, my grandfather, who, of course, are Harvard graduates, and managed the office for them, or I started working as soon as I was old enough to get working anywhere. I worked in their offices, too. It was great fun. They owned a building in Lynn, Massachusetts. And so I worked there in their offices as well. I wrote. And I didn't know shorthand, but I made up my own shorthand. Was able to write all kinds of things for them, or they said I was anyway.
Well, it's an amazing lineage, and what I'm interested in, it even goes back perhaps to the Mayflower. Your dad's
true.
I wanted to ask you about going to law school. You take a year at Boston University, and it's right off the bat, it seems that women have trouble in lots of fields, but law is almost not existent for most women. Is that right at that time?
Well, at that particular time, why did I go to law school? Because I got out of Connecticut College. And I made such a botch of my life. I went to Connecticut College, and I wanted to be, of course, I should have been, an English major. And so I started classes in something, literature, I guess, with the head of the English department. And she started talking about the Scottish play. And I got furious. I couldn't sit there and listen to, I love this story, so I'm enjoying it. I couldn't sit there and listen to Shakespeare, in this case, the Scottish play. And I couldn't listen to it being discussed as intellectual literature, which of course it is, and it's discussed all the time in schools everywhere all the time. I couldn't take that. For me, it was such a dramatic thing that if we couldn't work on it as a dramatic thing, I just couldn't handle it. I'm crazy, but that's the way people are, I guess, and that's what sort of leads them in various directions, isn't it?
Well, feelings, it is.
Feelings like that.
Despite the fact that you're in New England, despite the fact that your parents are quiet and dignified, you're a rather rambunctious young woman. You're pretty tough, and I think they feel that perhaps it's best to send you to a boarding school and also to get you involved before you go in community theater so that things are a little bit easier for you.
No.
You're
all wrong about absolutely everything.
Oh, I'm so glad that we're doing this. Okay. Wait, Estelle. Everything. I got the Mayflower right.
Oh, you're right about the history. But I had an older sister. She was 4 years older than I was. Now you got me off my track.
Well, I had said that you might have been a bit of a rambunctious child.
She was 4 years older than I was, and she was a hellion. She started drinking, I think, when she was about 12. And what I remember most about my entire childhood was my parents worrying about this older sister of mine. It was like, I was an afterthought, but I was a good, healthy individual. Nobody needed to care about me. The idea was that they had two children, and what one child had, the other one should have. So she had a convertible when she was 16. So when I was 16, they wanted to buy me a convertible. And I said, I don't want a convertible. There's this thing called the Priscilla Beach Drama Works down in Cape Cod, which is a summer program, theater program, and I want to go to that. I don't want convertible. Cars don't matter to me. I'm not in that line. I want to go to this theater school. So they said, oh, okay. So they sent me down to the Priscilla Beach Drama Works, which is where I started. And the reason I knew about that is that when I was only seven, something like that, we were part of a community theater. I did one play, Sleeping Beauty. I was on the birthday cake for Sleeping Beauty. And I had to cry, a little boat peep, and I've lost my sheep. And the birthday cake would be going round and round. That was one of my parts. And the woman who ran this company was, she ended up being the head of theater for all theater in New England, the school system. She was an extraordinary woman, you know, where you find that in various places with theater people. They're not all in New York. The people who go to New York go to New York, but other people who are extremely gifted in theater, developing, directing and producing, you know, they work in their communities. And so she worked in her community, this place thing called the Tavern Players, which my mother did props for. And then the first show I did, I was a frog. And when the frog suit came with a frog's head, and I went out for my first entrance, and I couldn't see the audience because I had on this frog head, I said to myself right then and there, hunched over on the stage, I said to myself, I am never wearing anything over my head on the stage again in my whole life, and I have kept to it. I couldn't see the audience, no. But I could always feel them, you know, and the matinees were great because all you heard all matinee was, if you're a really good actress with a really good play, all you heard was the pocketbooks open, click, sif, sif. You could get everybody crying, and you knew they were crying because you could hear the pocketbooks open.
Getting that handkerchief out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about your singing career as a young woman. You were singing with a band, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I sang with Jerry Jerome. His band was at the Roosevelt Hotel. Well, that was much later. That was much later after I came to New York, and I was already on the Today Show before I started.
I thought you were singing in... while you were at the law school.
Oh, yeah. I forgot the name of that band. I sang with them a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah. But the big thing is we're going to get you to New York. And I must tell you, it's such an extraordinary thing to talk about the Today Show and what it meant to me as a kid to watch it. I'm so interested in the fact that you were one of the people, the pioneer. You're literally a pioneer of television.
That's right. I was one of eight people who put together the first morning in television, and everybody said, it won't work, it won't work, it won't work. Then I was in London when playing in Miss Margarita's Way. When they started morning television, they were all saying, it won't work, it won't work. Saying, of course it will work, it worked.
Well, it did work.
Godfrey was then on morning television, and you know who else was?
Jack Parr was on.
No, he was at night.
He was originally on the daytime, in the morning, Jack Parr.
It was Today, Home, and Tonight.
Oh, no, that's what NBC did. That's what Pat Weaver and Mort
Warner. Yeah, that's right. That was Pat Weaver. We had this book in our desk drawers, about 3 inches thick, which was Pat Weaver's vision for television, because there was no television till I actually got into law school. We had one of the first televisions in New York, and that was when I was already in my first year of law school.
And
so, when was that? That was 1950 when television.
Well, even late 40s was your show of shows. But I wondered...
That was the first one. Oh, yeah, with Imogene Coca and Sid Caesar.
Carl Reiner. And your director, Howard Morris, who directed you in
That's
Don't Drink
right.
the Water.
Morris.
Yeah.
And then Dagmar was on something there. They always had some big book, some blonde person.
Yes. She was, when you were in London, they had Diana Dawes and we had Dagmar.
But yeah, right.
Let's talk in terms of you becoming a commentator. You start out writing, you're a PA, you produce, but then Dave Garraway, who's the host, thinks you should do some commentary, right?
Dave had, he was our first person to run the Today Show. And Ava Gardner was supposed to come on one morning. You know, we had celebrities on. Truman was president. He would walk by the window. They would shoot out the window at people who were walking along 49th Street. And so they had an interview outside there with Harry Truman when he became president, was in New York taking his morning walk. Whoa, that was a long time ago.
Anyhow,
we were in the RCA Exhibition Hall at that time. And there were eight of us who put that whole show together, even before Dave came and said, who should we get? Should we try to deal with Arthur Godfrey? Shall we try something else? And then Dave was in Chicago with a nighttime show. But he wanted to do this thing, so he came with his girlfriend to New York. They lived on 79th and Park. I remember where they lived. I remember going there. Oh, gosh.
Well, as you've said in interviews before, this was kind of your day job, but your love was to be, you wanted to act. That's what you wanted to do. And in 1956, you get a job with Happy Hunting. With the star is Ethel Merman. And I think your character was named Mary Mills. Not sure, but I think.
That's true.
And tell us about
the costumes.
Tell us a little bit about Ethel Merman, Estelle. This woman was a powerhouse, a true powerhouse,
yeah,
right?
I adored her. I adored her all my life. I had a big, when I was a kid, my sister played the piano, my older sister, and I had an act in which I impersonated Ethel Merman and also Al Jolson. But yeah, Ethel Merman was very special.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about the fact that you turned down going to Grace Kelly's wedding. Is that true? The Today Show wanted you to go there?
Yeah.
What was your reason?
Jerry Green was running the Today Show then, and he called me in and he said, I want you to go to the Grace Kelly wedding. And I said, I can't go. I had twins, and they had been born a couple months before that, maybe 3 months before that. And I said, I don't want to go. I did not like interview. I was getting to be the number one interviewer of people. And Marilyn Monroe had just come to New York to Arthur Miller was her boyfriend. So she just come to New York and so go over to Sutton Place and interview Marilyn Monroe. So I went over to Sutton Place. And I said, are you going to have many children? And she looked at me and said, well, I'm not even married yet. I really hated interviewing people. I just hated it. I'm from New England, you know, where you really don't ever talk unless you have to. And here I was basically invading people's lives, which is what that is. You know, myself and another woman who had come from California for the Today Show, Mary Kelly. And she didn't mind it. She was a big, rough and tough person. But I just found it, I just found it so, so difficult to ask people to talk about themselves.
Well, whether you like it or not, historically, you'll be known as the first female commentator on television. You were.
Yeah, I was. That's absolutely true.
That's
I
true.
Was.
And I know you went up to New Hampshire to interview Estes Kefauver, who was running for vice president.
Oh, that was funny. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that if you remember it.
Well, I can't remember much about it, except I know it was snowy and the American Red Cross were on the top of Mount Sunapee in the America where this they was it's still a ski place. And of course I have a house in Wolfboro, which we've had for four generations on Lake Winnipesaukee. So they said, go up here and do this thing. So we went up and did it for the American Red Cross. Yeah.
Well, acting has always been your love and always your passion. And I wanted to ask you, how did you handle rejection at the beginning of your career?
There was a guy named Ellis Rabb who had a company in Cambridge. It wasn't connected with Harvard, but it was in Cambridge. And so I was still living with my parents in Marblehead, which is about half an hour from where this, and I was trying very hard to get with this company. And then finally, I had some kind of a little job with a director who also worked with this company. And he said, I'm going to speak to them about you to get you into the company. Because I said, you know, I don't want to be famous. I don't want to be on Broadway. I want to belong to a theater company. And that didn't seem to be working out. So this director said, here, I'm going to introduce you to this company that I'm with. And we'll get you into that company. And so I met with them, and they did not take me. And I just went home and threw myself on my bed and cried and cried and cried and cried because I couldn't get in. Some people just don't like me.
It's impossible to. Absolutely ridiculous. That means they're just intimidated. They're intimidated, Estelle.
Well, they don't want somebody like, let me put it that way. They don't want somebody like me. And then in Brooklyn, they started a company. And then they wanted to give me a secondary role in that company. I was leading actress. I didn't want any secondary role. But I could not. Same thing happened. Nobody really wanted me. I don't know, maybe just too strong, outspoken, or I don't know, because I know I'm as good an actress as anybody else, but it's just as, it's funny. I haven't ever thought of it until now that I'm 98. I thought of it last month.
Well, it took a while.
But you know, you can't, when you're working in the theater, you can't think about those things.
That's right.
You go first. I had a script I was trying to get done. So I'd go, and the person would say, no, we don't want to do that script. And then I remember Lynn Meadow at Manhattan Theater Club. I gave it to her, and she said, oh, that's not my cup of tea. And I got so mad inside because I wanted so desperately to get this play of Marguerite Duras on called Suzanne Adler. But, I mean, that someone would just say to me, that's not my cup of tea, was and, you know, something really funny about 2 months ago, I found myself in the other position. Somebody handed me a script, which I read, and I thought, oh, boy, but that's not my cup of tea. And I thought, here I am at the other end of a long, long road.
Yeah, it's true. Well, let's talk about your first movie, Ladybug, Ladybug. That's the first movie I think you did. Frank Perry is coming, and he and Eleanor are married, and they're coming off a huge hit of David and Lisa. And this is your first movie. Were you frightened? Were you nervous? Were you excited? What were your feelings, if you remember, about Ladybug?
Well, I was on tour with Carol Channing and the Millionaires. I was on a summer. We had summer stock in those days, which I worked in from the time I was in high school, in summer stock. So because we had a Class A summer stock company in Marblehead, Massachusetts, so I'd already worked with Helen Hayes and her daughter, who later died, and Cloris Leachman, and Kay Francis. Nobody will remember that name but me.
Oh, I thought she was great. She was a tough cookie.
Yeah, she was. Well, you had to be tough in those days.
You did.
And Joan Bennett, when she was having an affair with somebody else's husband who shot him then in the you-know-what.
That's right. Jennings Lang. Jennings Lang.
That's right. That's who it was. Boy, you know a lot.
Well, but I am interested, though, in talking to you about one thing we haven't talked about, and I skipped over, but I'm fascinated by the fact that as a young woman, your first real serious boyfriend was Jack Lemmon.
Oh, well, we grew up together. He lived four houses away from me in Wolfsboro. So we grew up together from the time we were 12. Or I was 12. He was a little older, maybe 15.
Well, you sing, but I remember because I knew Jack, he could really play the piano. He was a terrific. Did you guys do that together? Did you sing and play piano?
Do you remember? Yeah. I had a whole repertoire of songs that he had written. And I could also play the piano from the time I was three. I played the piano. So I could play the piano and do these songs. And, you know, now that I'm 98, I've forgotten them all. The other day, I tried to think, what the heck were those songs and how did I play them? But yeah, he was my boyfriend for a very long time, my first boyfriend. My mother was furious. He's not good enough for you, she said. Don't keep going out with that boy. He's not good enough for you. But he was my first boyfriend. We lived four houses apart in Wolfboro, New Hampshire. He lived in Boston, but I lived in Marblehead.
Well, you guys, years later, in Los Angeles, did a play together.
Yeah, we did a play together then.
You with Ernest Thompson, who had written On Golden Pond.
Yeah.
But this was a different kind of a play. And
it was a good play.
Yeah, I never got to New York, though, right, Estelle?
I think it was called Two People.
Yes.
No, it didn't.
I think you played...
We played in California and we played in Seattle.
I think you played in Denver as well.
We did play in Denver, yes.
Yeah.
Because Jack had an oxygen tent because we played in Denver. That's how I know we played in Denver.
Well, I wanted...
But he was by then, it was very sad. He was by then drinking heavily. And when we were going to do that play, I said, you know, I don't want to get into that. And they said, he's not drinking anymore. He's given up drinking. He won't be drinking anymore. Okay, so I'll do it. So we did pretty well for a while. But then, you know, what happened all of a sudden, San Francisco. And he was drunk. And you know, you just really, a two-character play, you just really can't play it with someone who's kind of falling down drunk.
Wow, that must have been such a tough time.
So then I was giving an interview to somebody in San Francisco and didn't know any better. And so I mentioned that we were having a really hard time because of his drinking, which when I say it now, I should have known I should keep my mouth shut about a thing like that. But then it came in the paper, the big story about the play and me and about how Jack was drinking. And he was so mad at me that it was impossible to act with him. He would be so furious on this.
Wow. Yes.
Then you just didn't know what to do, except, you know, we were young and, you know, I knew my lines, so whatever. It was just a very hard time, and I don't know whatever happened to him, but that was really too bad. Because in the beginning, you know, we were girlfriend and boyfriend. We thought this would last forever, but it didn't.
No. Well, maybe your mother was right, Estelle.
No, my mother was not right. Mothers should keep their mouths shut about their children's love affairs, if you ask me.
Have you been able to do that?
Yes, I certainly have. I have two girls, and I'm not even going to mention all their love affairs. But I certainly never, you know, I'd come home from a date with Jack, and she'd be sitting in the living room waiting for me. Poor thing. Well, we lived way, way out in the woods on Lake Winnipesaukee, and I think half of her was just didn't like being alone, you know.
Well,
in the middle of a very big, big wood on Lake Winnipesaukee, and her kid was out in a Model T car with Jack Lemmon. But I thought afterwards that she might be frightened there, but who knows? Because, well, then I got another place in the woods. This is a much, much, much later story, and my sister and brother-in-law came to visit me there, and I left them there while I went to town to get something, and when it came back, she was livid because she'd been so afraid of being in the woods, which was not something I'm afraid of. I'm very happy in the woods.
I wanted to ask you to go back to that ladybug, about how it was to do a first movie. Were you excited? Were you frightened? Do you remember?
The story is, of course, there is a story. The fact is, I did not like movies. I did not want to do movies. The stage was my love from the time I started at the age of 6. The stage was what I loved to be on. Walk out on the stage and is what I loved to do then, my whole life from the age of 6. And now at 98, the same thing.
That's right.
Love to walk out on the stage. Listen to that audience out there. They go, it goes dark. They go quiet. It's the most exciting thing in the world for me. I did spend my whole life on the stage.
One of the people we both cared for a great deal, and I worked with a lot, in fact, I did his last two plays, was Arthur Penn. And I know he meant a great deal to you as well.
Yeah, he sure did. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about, he gave you the script of Bonnie and Clyde, but you were involved perhaps in a new theater company at that time.
I was with Murray Sisko and Gene Hackman and Dusty Hoffman. Yeah. I was not interested in films. I didn't want to do a film. He said, I want you to read the script. I said, I don't want to do it. And so I started reading it, and I thought, why doesn't he get Madeline Sherwood? I'm not interested in movies. And then the more I read, the more I thought, whoa, my gosh, this is not a supporting role. This is an incredible opportunity. So I did it.
Yes, and I think Arthur mentioned to me that it was you who recommended Gene Hackman for the role.
Yes. Yes, because we had been working on something on the stage. Dusty and Gene and I were working on a Mary Shusko play on the stage. And Gene and I worked so well together. It was, it's like we, I don't know how I really talk about that or know about that or anything. But we didn't have a particularly personal relationship, but we worked very well. When we were on the stage, we were both in the same play. And that's hardly ever the situation. But it was true. He had the same kind of rhythms that I had, and I was sorry to watch his life go along and then disappear. It was too bad, even though I wasn't particularly friendly with him, but he was. I did have a wonderful stage workout with him.
Well, not only that, but I think it's fair to say that you played brother and sister in I Never Sang for My Father
Did. Yes,
I mean,
we
those are some terrific acting performances that you both did. And I felt I never saw the one with you and Dusty and Gene, but
no, that wasn't.
Was it called Fragments? Was that the name of it? Fragments, something like that. I don't know, a Siskel play.
Yeah, I know. Wasn't that the name of it? Was that the name of it?
I think it was called Fragments. During the shooting of Bonnie and Clyde, Estelle, I know this is not the thing you only think about as an actor, but did you have a feeling of success, or it was not necessarily
Arthur was really down on his luck at the time. So everybody had to work for very little money. And no. So nobody had any thought of any kind of success anywhere in the near future. Yeah, we just all did it for one reason or another because we liked Arthur. You know, I like to work for Arthur because I've worked for him and I found it profoundly exciting to work for him. So I was happy that way. I don't know what other people were thinking about or why they were doing it or any. Oh, well, I know Faye had never done anything before, so she was looking for a big opportunity. That's about all I remember. It's a long time ago. Gosh, Julian.
I know. Well,
give me a break here. Thanks.
I can't, Estelle. I have to keep going. I do want to ask you this. Gene always wanted to be a movie star.
Yes, he did.
I was
so mad at him. And I remember coming out of his trailer crying one day to Arthur Penn and say, he just wants to be in the movie. He just wants to be in the movie. He doesn't want to be on the stage anymore. I remember. Can you imagine that? I remember it so well. With him about that and then coming out and crying to Arthur because Gene didn't want to be a stage actor.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's quite interesting in the history of Bonnie and Clyde that a lot of people don't know, I'm sure you do, was that initially it was panned by the New York Times. It did not do business at all. And Warner Brothers pulled it from theaters. And Warren single-handedly went in, got to them, and convinced them to go back and change the ad campaign and make this an important movie. So it was Warren who saved Bonnie and Clyde. It was relegated over. It was finished. Amazing story.
Yeah, it's a good story, and you've got it absolutely right. And you know what else he did? He went around to theaters and worked on their sound systems theaters for him. He said, it's important the sound be exactly right for this. He probably was right. I thought he was a lunatic. We all thought he was a lunatic. Warren, you know, he had been a pretty boy up till that moment. And then all of a sudden he became this big, profoundly intelligent producer. So it was wonderful, really. It was a great experience. And he's a great guy. He was a great guy. Is he still around? No, I don't know.
Yeah, he is. He is. I wanted to say to you that years later, you worked with him and Dick Tracy. You worked. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd go anywhere and do anything for him. You know, he was a good boss. And he's a really nice guy.
And that ends part one with the incredible and outspoken Estelle Parsons. And as you can hear, she suffers no fools. So please join us next week for part two.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Adavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world with content production that powers your growth. Podcasts, audiobooks, and everything in between. Learn more at adavita.com.
Produced by Adavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.